Welcome back.
Well, with Josephine had attributes considered essential by Napoleon. She remained for him always and to the end une vraie femme. Lazare Carnot would describe her as a woman in the fullest meaning of the term, and two things, he would say, become a woman, rouge and tears. Her preoccupation with dress, her tact and languid grace, her easy and becoming tears, her tender voice, even her debts and her lies appealed to this southern misogynist.
With Valentine's Day just around the corner, this month's book club looks at one of history's best-known love stories, the relationship between Napoleon Bonaparte and Josephine de Beauharnais.
Napoleon's family would never take into account the intensity of his desire for Josephine. The man who had found his sexual initiation by a prostitute disappointing, who had proclaimed that love was but a social feeling, who had observed that the French are entirely absorbed by eroticism, and who had written only the previous year that he dreamed of a simple conjugal attachment, was now helplessly involved in emotions he had not believed existed.
Married in 1796 and divorced in 1810, the romance between this fascinating pair coincided directly with the zenith of Napoleon's own military and political power. Joining us to discuss Napoleon and Josephine, An Improbable Marriage by Evangeline Bruce, our book club choice for February, are Laura O'Brien, lecturer in modern European history with the University of Sunderland, journalist Carol Hunt, and Hugh Goff, emeritus professor of modern European history at University College Dublin. Carol, first of all, why do you think Napoleon and Josephine continue to arouse so much interest, so much curiosity as one of history's great pairings? Is it because one of them is Napoleon?
Well, yes, that would, of course, if you know, he had been the local butcher, I don't think we would be quite so much. But I think it was because the love endured so much that even when he had to divorce her, and he really did, he did not want to divorce her. You know, from what we know, he was very ambivalent about it. She was his star. She was his look. She was the only person who understood him. He was forced to he wanted an heir, his family were forcing him to, and she stayed loyal to him right to the very, very end. And I think that sort of a love affair is very
unusual.
Attractive.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let's start, Laura, with Josephine herself. Who was she? This is the woman who would one day become Empress of France. Where does she start? Where does her story begin?
Well, Josephine is born in 1763. That makes her 6 years older than her future husband, which, of course, his family would never let him forget. She was not called Josephine to begin with. Her birth name was Marie-Joseph Rose, and Napoleon started calling her Josephine. And he had previously given a different name to a former future fiancé. So this was a habit that he had of giving women more romantic names that he thought were more appropriate. She is born of a French family, but she's born in the island of Martinique in the Caribbean, where her father ran a rather shabby sugar plantation. But they saw themselves as sort of minor aristocracy because her father had been a page at Versailles when he was a young boy or a teenager. So often you get contemporary sources referring to Josephine's status as a Creole or a Creole, where she's seen as this sort of exotic character, even if she is of a French family. And then she comes to France in 1779 when she's 16 to marry a man called Alexandre de Beauharnais, her first husband, who again is a minor aristocrat, and his uncle happens to be in an affair with Josephine's aunt. So she wants the money in the family to stay in the clutches of her family, so she arranges a marriage between her niece and this Alexandre character.
He's not best pleased with what he gets, is he?
No, she arrives in France and he thinks, what's this? You know, this, you've sent me this chubby 16-year-old, you know, ingenue from the provinces or the colonies as such. And he doesn't think she's good enough for him, so he treats her abominably, really. And they have two children, Eugène and Hortense, but he cast out on Hortense's paternity. He travels to Martinique with his own mistress to try and dig up dirt on Josephine, to say that she was of bad morals, that she had been putting herself about before she married him, and so on. So it's not a happy marriage. to put it simply.
OK, we'll come back to him because he gets his comeuppance at some point in the story. We'll find out how presently. Hugh, tell us then a little bit about the beginnings of Napoleon Bonaparte and where that legend begins.
Well, Bonaparte's born on an island, rather like Josephine, I suppose, but it's a different island, Corsica. And he comes from a family of pretty poor nobility. His father was a lawyer, and he was the second child. And Corsica had become French just the year before he was born. It was ceded by Genoa to France. And so the Bonaparte family profited from French government largesse. The kids were educated in the mainland in France. And so Bonaparte trains as an artillery officer and enters the French army during the course of the 1780s. And when the revolution breaks out, Bonaparte, like a lot of people who become prominent in the revolution later on, is an obscure character. And he gets involved in Corsican politics in the early part of the revolution, but he gets his fingers burnt there because there's a local conflict going on between the Bonaparte family and Paoli, who was the old Corsican patriot who'd been exiled to England and came back in the revolution. So Bonaparte leaves Corsica definitively in 1793. I don't think he ever goes back. And he then takes part in the repression of a rebellion during the Terror in the south of France and begins a sort of fairly rapid rise to prominence from there.
Mm. Now, in relation then to the Terror, I mean, we know that, I suppose, the single most significant figure in that one would have been Maximilien Robespierre. But in the midst of all of this, Josephine and her husband, Alexandre, find themselves caught up.
Yes. Well, he is arrested and he is sent to jail. And of course, because she is his wife, she is arrested a few days later and sent to a different jail, where interestingly, actually, she meets a man called Lazare Hoche, who eventually becomes the leader of the expedition to Ireland a few years later. But she falls madly in love with him and they have a very, very passionate affair. And her poor husband.
Let's point out, by the way, that the husband is having an affair in a different jail with somebody else.
Oh yes, but see, these are the last days. You know, the days of the Terror. If
have
you survived,
sex and be merry, for
exactly,
tomorrow we die.
If you survived the lists that were called out every morning in the prisons of the people who are going to be taken off in the tumbrils to be executed that day, if you survived that, you had one day left to live, and you partied like, because there may not have been a tomorrow. So she certainly, you know, made the most use of her time in the jail with Lazare Hoche. Her husband and unfortunately was executed, and she was saved by Thermidor. She was saved by the execution of the leaders of
so-called
the
so-called Thermidorian reaction, the execution of Robespierre and so on and so forth. He missed out surviving by, what was it, about 5 or 6
it
days?
Only a few days, yeah. Yes. Mm.
Okay, so he was definitely...
Josephine Star, her luck, you see.
Napoleon would not have had him as a general because
no.
He was unlucky. Okay, then post... the Terror, during the era, if you like, of the so-called Thermidor. You reckon, Laura, that Josephine de Beauharnais becomes a kind of an 18th century it girl?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have this sort of, in a way, what Carol was saying about this idea of you in the prisons in the last days of the Terror, the people who are living this quite licentious life. And that kind of carries over into the Thermidorian reaction because they're so glad to have made it out that they just have this live at large almost. You know, they're sort of having parties and parties are back and theatres are opening again, which hadn't happened during the Terror. And in the midst of all this, Josephine does become this little sort of star. She's part of a group of women that are called the Merveilleuses, or the Marvellous Ones. They're known for their raunchy, daring dress. There's a Gilray, I think, cartoon of these women in their sort of translucent muslin dresses, even in the depths of winter. They're applauded everywhere they go. And so she's close friends with a woman called Thérésia Tallien, who she's friends with in prison, so they carry that on. And they're sort of the celebrities, part of this social group that becomes celebrated in the post-Thermidor Paris. But of course, at the same time you have this going on, you also have massive social divisions because prices are going up and there's unrest at the same time as you have this sort of social renewal in the city.
Okay, so she is a kind of a social butterfly at this stage. In the meantime, Hugh, Napoleon is making a name for himself in the military.
Yes, he was dead lucky in a way because Napoleon, he was arrested briefly at the end of the Terror because of activity in the south of France, but he was released, he came to Paris and he turned down a few appointments. He's an extremely selfish man, as you'll find out later. And he turns down a few appointments and he was really meant to be appointed to the army in the west of France, but he wouldn't go there because he disliked Hoche who had been, though this didn't enter into it at this stage, who had known Josephine well in prison. But he saw Archie's arrival. So he wanted to, he sort of stayed on in Paris, and he benefited from the fact that he knew one of the most influential politicians of the of this period of the reaction, a man called Barras. And in the autumn of 1795, there was a royalist uprising in Paris against the constitution of the new regime, the so-called Directory, and one of the particular provisions of it, which needn't concern us here. And Bonaparte was put in charge of the repression of that revolt. And he was quite ruthless. He didn't like crowd activity at all. He'd seen the overthrow of the king in August 1792 and been appalled by it, by crowd violence. He hated it all his life. And so he had this put down, the Vendémiaire Rising, as it's called, in 1795. And he rises to prominence as a result of that, and he cultivates it.
And you mentioned Barras, Paul Barras, because this is the connection. This is how he ends up meeting Josephine.
It is. Josephine, at this stage, Osha's gone back to his young wife. Who
it's very young.
Very, 16. Very, yes. Yeah. And reluctantly, seemingly. And Josephine starts an affair and becomes basically the mistress of Barras. And she's his official mistress. But, you know, he's very flamboyant. He's a man who likes parties. Herself and her friends entertain him and his friends, and the whole political centre then revolves around them. Now, he is the one then who introduces her to his newly found young man, Napoleon.
He starts to cultivate Napoleon.
He does. And he sees the talent. He does see Napoleon's talent. But whether he wants to get rid of Josephine or not at this time, we're not quite sure, but it certainly looks like that. So she's introduced to him and she's told that this would be a good thing. This would be a good match for her. She's not very impressed, though. She's not impressed with him at all.
And a lot of people are not impressed with Napoleon.
Now,
and there's a hygiene issue amongst
us. Yes, he's small. He doesn't smell very well. His hair looks awful. He's very, very pale, scruffy. They dressed so magnificently then, and they were so flamboyant. He just was totally opposite to everything that Josephine would have liked. But he adored her.
And how come then you have this shift towards a romantic relationship between the two of them, Laura?
I think it's he goes in head over heels, even though he had written to his former fiancée, Désirée Clary, saying, oh, there's lots of these old, ugly women hanging around Thérésia Taillien. Which we think might have meant Josephine, but he goes head over heels once she starts paying him attention, because no one else was. But she is quite cool at the same time. But I think it has a lot to do with Vendémiaire, because suddenly he's in the ascent. And of course, Barras is protecting him, he is promoting him, he's introducing him to his social circles. So because Josephine is a pragmatist, because she thinks about power, she thinks about influence, Vendémiaire does change things, I think, for her. But she remains very reticent, even as he becomes passionate to the point of obsession about her. And she retains this kind of connection with Barras all the way through this. I think what eventually pushes her to agree to Napoleon's proposals of marriage, which he was making from the off. And it should be noted, I think, that they had begun a physical relationship, which didn't necessarily mean anything to her, but clearly did to him, was the fact that Barras was saying, of course you can go and marry my wonderful young protégé, but also the fact that she has this definitive break with Lazare Hoche, who has definitively ditched her towards the end of 1795, start of 1796.
The wedding was hardly a fairy tale wedding, was it?
Yeah, I mean, there's the famous story, and I mean, there's a well-known epic 1927 film about Napoleon, which is, you know, stunning in and of itself. But there's
That's
a scene,
the Abel Gance film,
yeah, which is just, I saw it before Christmas and mind blowing as a film. But they show this wedding, and you have Napoleon at home scribbling his plans for the army of Italy, and you've got Josephine parading around the room, waiting and waiting and waiting. He kept her waiting till about midnight. So,
well, apparently the film is 5 hours long, so they could obviously depict the waiting.
With dinner breaks, I should point out, it was worth it in the end. I will emphasise that, very much worth it. But so Gans shows it as if Napoleon was working on his plans for the army of Italy. Other people say he was forging his birth certificate to make himself look older, to change his place of birth to France and not Corsica. But regardless, he kept her waiting. They had a rushed ceremony and there were some errors on the marriage certificate.
So there was a birthing controversy, or there would have been a birthing controversy in France in the 1790s.
Well, I mean, maybe it was, again, pragmatic. Maybe he was thinking, what happens if we lose Corsica? He wanted to, you know, it's showing himself as French, because, of course, he had changed his name to something more French from Napoleone di Bonaparte to something much more French, Napoleon Bonaparte. So that delays the wedding, and it's rushed, and, you know, everything is sort of last minute. And then, of course, he has to disappear off to the army of Italy 2 days later. So they have 2 days together as a married couple, and then he's off.
Just some observations and questions coming in on text. What was the age difference between Napoleon and Josephine? I think we established it was six years. She was 6 years older than him. Somebody else says, I read that Napoleon was far from a sensitive lover, more of a JFK character than a Don Juan. I'm not sure how sensitive Don Juan was.
Seemingly he was in later years, and he was very fond of telling Josephine about all his conquests and, you know, how he could basically be, you know, arrive and leave within a very, very
short period.
Three minutes. Okay. Could you compare Napoleon and Josephine to any contemporary couples? Are we talking Posh and Becks, or are we talking JFK and Jackie? Who are we talking about?
That is an interesting one. I think
Barack and Michelle.
No. I mean, they're a much more equal power base, I think, the two of them.
I think it's a difficult one, that one.
We may come back to it if a comparison occurs to anybody.
Carla Brunei, maybe.
Oh, right, okay.
I mean, but I think the interesting thing is that they start from a position where she's the one in charge,
yes,
and then it turns to she's begging him to be in. To remain, she needs him to stay. So,
well, it's because he had power,
of course.
And I suppose also there's the Carla Bruni Sarkozy comparison is apt because of the height difference as well. For a history show,
at least be accurate about
Napoleon's height. Even by modern standards, he wouldn't be seen as small. 5'8" isn't small; it's quite average.
It says he's 5'2". However, I read a few weeks ago that the 5'2" story may have been English propaganda, and that he was probably 5'7", which, given that Sarkozy is 5'6" and François Hollande is 5'8", is not
but
that bad.
But 5'6", 5'7" would have been good for the 18th century.
Very good.
People didn't grow as tall.
Now, the 2 days of marriage, Hugh, and the Italian campaign begins. But he does, I mean, he drags her, basically, eventually across the Alps to Italy, doesn't he?
Well, she doesn't want to go. I mean, he goes off to Italy and he expects her to follow him, and she doesn't because she has other business to attend to in Paris. I mean, she was not faithful to the marriage from the very beginning. So he's madly in love and leading a brilliant military campaign in southern France and northern Italy, and she's steadfastly refusing to come. And eventually she did go, but she went under sufferance. So from the very beginning, the marriage sort of starts with her not being particularly interested in following it through, and he feeling very lonely while he's achieving these military victories, yeah.
Now, we'll fast forward a little bit to a point where Napoleon essentially now has complete power in France. He is about to become emperor. And I think, Carol, to some extent, the coronation ceremony held at Notre Dame in December 1804, it makes up for the wedding a bit, doesn't it?
Well, it didn't. I mean, at this stage, he is in complete control also of Josephine. The affairs have gone, long gone, and she is the one, you know, who desperately needs him. She has not given him a child. Now, she's had two children of her own, but she has not given him a child. His family detest her. They do not want her crowned. They really do hate her. Extraordinary. So, even up to before the coronation, he's still talking about divorcing her, but he doesn't. And there is a huge coronation, and his sisters are absolutely appalled to hear that they're supposed to hold her train. And there's all of these delicacies that have to be negotiated, and the amount of trouble that has gone they have to go through for this coronation. It really is something that you wouldn't really see today, even, you know, with the biggest of royalties. But anyway, she is crowned. She's crowned Empress of France, and she's still with Napoleon at that
stage. And the famous portrait by David is of him placing a crown
on her head. Yes, also what they had to do though, you see, they had the Pope who was supposed to be,
but they actually
hadn't been married within the church at all. So we're back to the marriage thing. They actually had to get married again before they were crowned as emperor and empress. So all sorts of
okay, so we'll skip from the second marriage and the coronation to the divorce because, as Carol has suggested, the issue of the absence of an heir, that's the straw that broke the camel's back, wasn't it?
Obviously she has these two children with Alexandre de Beauharnais. So she has Eugène and Hortense gets married off then to Napoleon's younger brother, and she produces a child called Louis Napoleon, who then becomes Napoleon III. But, of course, where is Josephine's child with Napoleon? This is the key issue. He has set up a dynasty as far as he's concerned. And there is a question, is it her age? Is it the shock of being in the prison in the Terror? Is it possibly a bad abortion at some point? They suggest that it may have been a backstreet abortion at some stage that could have prevented her from having children again. But for him, and especially for his family, this is an issue, because without an heir, there is no dynasty. And the Bonapartes will not continue as what they see themselves as the sort of the rulers of France.
OK, to finalise matters then, the Bonapartes conducted an official divorce ceremony in front of their families and members of the court. It all sounds a little bit bizarre in the 21st century. During the ceremony, both Napoleon and Josephine read out statements of their devotion to each other. This is a very strange divorce indeed, despite the fact that the event was intended to officially bring their marriage to an end. And these speeches were intensely emotional, as we'll hear now in this extract from Napoleon's statement to Josephine.
First, the emperor spoke. He announced the divorce, then, pushing his notes aside, started, "God alone knows what this resolve has cost my heart. I have found courage for it only in the conviction that it serves the best interests of France. I have only gratitude to express for the devotion and tenderness of my well-beloved wife. She has adorned 13 years of my life. The memory thereof will remain forever engraved upon my heart."
An extremely odd divorce indeed. By the way, somebody, Martin from Skibbereen, has texted in to say that the parallel in terms of modern couples, latter-day couples, is Hillary and Bill Clinton, with Napoleon being Hillary. Thank you very much indeed for that one, Martin. Let's, Hugh, briefly look at their lives after the divorce. Napoleon marries Marie-Louise of Austria, secures the line, but then, you know, things start to go badly wrong for him in 1814 and then again in 1815.
That's it. I mean, he, as you say, he marries Marie-Louise. He'd proved he could have a child because he'd had a child by a Polish aristocrat who he was quite fond of, Marie Waleska. And so once he discovered it wasn't he who was the problem, the marriage to Marie-Louise went ahead. It was a kind of hostage marriage, really, because she was very young. It was a political marriage. Austria had been defeated, and so they had no option but to give him a princess, and he had her. And they were married. Napoleon then goes on to, he's suffering in Spain, but he launches the fatal attack on Russia in 1812. He gets pushed back. In 1813, the French undergo their worst casualties of the entire revolutionary Napoleonic period in battles in Germany. And he's overthrown initially in March of 1814, off to Elba, comes back, deposed again and exiled to St. Helena. Now, the marriage then had broken by 1814 because Marie-Louise didn't go to Elba with him. When he was exiled to Elba, he wanted her to come with him, but his letters were intercepted on the way. She never discovered that he wanted her. She wasn't all that fond of him, although she'd grown to respect him. And she found another lover in a man called Count Nieperg, by whom she had two or three children, so we assume it was an intimate relationship. And so the marriage broke up then and there, and Napoleon never saw his wife again after Elba.
And Carol, Josephine herself died in 1814 when he was in exile.
She did. What wonderful timing. A woman who had such great taste all her life, she even knew when to die. And and he was devastated, of course, when he heard this. Strangely enough, though, I mean, he was the one who divorced her because he wanted to, you know, found his empire and his children succeed him. She was the one, actually, through her daughter and then through her grandchildren, who ended up being related to practically all the royal families in Europe, bar the British. So, posthumously, you could say, she
success,
became royal.
Success at the end. Laura O'Brien, Carol Hunt and Hugh Gough, many thanks for joining me this evening to discuss our February book club choice, Napoleon and Josephine, An Improbable Marriage by Evangeline Bruce. We've put lots of information about this pair on our website, rte.ie/radio1/history show. Check that one out. Incidentally, in terms of big anniversaries this year, people's sights will be very much on World War One, but 2014 also marks the 200th anniversary of Napoleon's abdication and the end of the French Empire. And our book club choice for March is St. Patrick's World, The Christian Culture of Ireland's Apostolic Age by Liam de Puer, published by Four Courts Press. We'll be discussing Patrick, the historical figure, on our 9th of March programme in advance of our annual feast day the following weekend. After the break, how a marauding horde of emus humiliated the Australian army in the 1930s.